Right, his old needle ball and airspeed.
You bet. Airspeed, yeah. Those three instruments have to tell you just what you're doing.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't have an instrument rating either, but boy, I kept out of that fog and haze. Mm-hmm. If I couldn't see and began to get into something where my equilibrium was endangered by, boy, I turn around fast. And I turn around before I couldn't see things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd know, I could see the ground, you see. Oh, it's so foolish when you aren't a good instrument pilot and you don't have your ground navigation points and radio contacts. So foolish to to go into it, especially in a country like Siberia.
Well, for many years I flew that Teller, Wales, and Shishmaref mail run out of Nome. Simply because we had such a turnover of pilots up there with Alaska Airlines that I used to give them that Unalakleet run most of the time because there was timber and the coast to follow down around that way. But you'd get up Teller, Wales, and Shishmaref, and there wasn't any trees up there, and there was an awful lot of wind.
Yes,
and
yes.
It was a little tougher route to fly.
That was.
But I knew it. See, I knew every turn in the coast up there and country between Shishmaref and Teller, and, you know, I knew all the creeks and everything. I used to follow the creeks up through the fog and follow the rivers down into the coast up there at Shishmaref and go in there and land on the beach and, you know, the way we used to do.
Oh, yes.
But,
I remember now when you were up there, I'm just beginning to come back to me.
But in the years I was over there, there was a lot of pilots killed. Wien pilots, Alaska pilots.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. A lot of pilots killed every year over there.
I tried to tell our pilots when I was running it here about that weather condition and turn back. I never minded the expense of a pilot turning back as far as gasoline was concerned, just so they didn't bust up the airplanes.
Right.
There's another day coming and it's generally good.
Yes.
And I found that out myself. Now I had to, I flew the Ford that 5 years that we had it, and then Alaska Airlines bought it in 1940.
Yeah, it was in Anchorage when I first came up here.
Oh yes, 8419.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have trouble with the Ford because it was a good bush airplane.
Yeah.
I liked it very much. Many trips I'd have to come all the way back because the wind wasn't just right. Like over at Caribou Creek, it's a small field, 1,200 feet or something like that. And I came in there, and those hills are so close to the field.
It's a one-way canyon over there, too.
Yes.
There's quite a few airplanes scattered up and down that canyon right now.
There are. And I came over there once, and there was a crosswind down over the closest hill on this side. And I said, uh-oh, I'm liable to get some drops in there that I can't pull out of with a heavy load of freight. I was hauling one or two loads of freight for a little mining outfit up the creek a little farther. I think I had close to capacity load, light on gas. I said, uh-oh, it's not safe. I'm liable to lose the airplane. We'll go back. It was only 50 miles back to Fairbanks, Caribou Creek on the salt jacket. So, came back. The next day, it looked different. The weather looked different. And I said, well, maybe the wind is all right today. If it dies down, it'll help. And I went over there and had a nice landing. No wind troubles. So, the profit wasn't so good on the trip, but because of I used 60 gallons an hour, cruising the way I did, four Wasps. That was one of the best bush airplanes we ever had.
To do that pays for itself in saved materials and repairs, and in the long run, your profit is greater for doing that.
Well, in 44, when I first went over to Nome, The Hamilton had been retired already, and it was sitting up by the Red Hangar.
Yes, yes.
And it kind of sticks in my mind that somebody said it had a cracked spar or something in it. What really yes. did happen to that?
Sig was flying it, and he went down to Solomon, and he had a heavy load of freight in it. And as I remember, he told it, I think that the fitting on the lower part of the gear dropped.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't damage the wing in any way, but they fixed it up to fly it back, but it had damaged cross bracing between the landing gear strut and the fuselage,
mm-hmm.
about 8 feet in that area. One of the cross members in the wing
mm-hmm.
had broken.
I see.
And now I'm not sure about what happened in the first place, whether it was a strut outside or
mm-hmm.
just that inside. I can't quite remember. That
I
was
can't either.
The
I've
Hornet.
Heard the story.
The Hornet. All they had to do is get new part
mm-hmm.
or make the legal and licensed
mm-hmm.
new part. But Sig and Hank Miller just didn't get around to it.
Oh, Hank, he was quite a... He'd been up there about 10 years when I arrived on the scene, you know. Hank and I used to work together all the time because I was a mechanic when I first went up there. I worked the first 3 years up there as a mechanic.
Oh, you did, huh?
So Hank and I, of course, used to work together all the time up there.
Oh, yes, you did, huh?
Of course, we had the hangar there.
Yes.
Alaska Airlines, old Hans Morrow hangar.
Yes, that's right.
And Weens didn't have any hangar other than the Red Hangar up on the other field at that time, so
yeah.
old Hank was out there working on the snowdrift about half the time, you know, because
yeah.
the way that old Red Hangar was faced up on the hill there, it used to get the northeast wind would come
yeah.
in there and it hit that hangar door and the snow would bounce out, so you'd get out about as far as from here to the wall and you had a 6-foot snowdrift
yes,
out there,
yeah.
just as hard as what you were talking about over in Siberia there.
Uh-huh.
And so they
yes.
didn't use it over there much in that
no.
time. So there, poor old Hank, you know, he'd be working out on the snowdrifts over there, and he used to feel sorry for him sometimes, and he let him put an airplane in the hangar there, you know, and do some work on it.
Yes, yes.
But in those days, everybody worked together. It didn't matter who they were working for, Bill Munns
no.
or Weems or Alaska, you know, and we all kind of helped each other.
Yes. Yeah. Some of you had trouble with Hans Merrill
mm-hmm.
in those early days. He didn't like his competition.
Mm-hmm. He was a German.
I see.
And he got killed over there on the portage between Yonel Clayton and Caltech.
Yeah.
He was looking for Fred Chambers over there that time.
Yes.
Fred Chambers was sitting on the ground over at Caltech. And Hans had picked up a load of reindeer meat at Yonel Clayton.
Yeah.
He had the mechanic with him.
Yes.
And they'd gone over there, and it was snowing, and they'd followed the river up, and they'd got up to the portage over the ridge there,
yeah.
over the Caltag, you know, and they'd gotten in the timber up there and turned around, and I guess Hans must have hooked a wing or something and on a tree or something up there. And
yes, he hooked
the
wing.
Went in with that load of reindeer meat, and they killed both of them.
Ooh.
They didn't tie it down either.
Yeah.
But that kind of a crack-up might have tore anything loose.
And that was with an old SR-7 Gullwing.
Yes.
Which actually was the first Gullwing. The
yes.
SR-6 was the last straight wing.
That's right. That
had
was
the flaps on it.
Wasn't that the white one?
I believe
painted
so.
Painted white.
Yeah.
You know, earlier I said people who interview you are always asking about these firsts. And the reindeer that Bob just mentioned made me think, I wanted to ask you, one of the firsts that you did was to herd reindeer with an airplane.
Oh,
I
yes.
read that somewhere.
We didn't herd them,
you
but
didn't, what?
We took the herders out there so they could locate exactly where they were, and that was out of Golovin on the peninsula that you cross over from Moses Point.
Mm-hmm.
And we located them right quickly, but they would have to travel so far and long to find them.
So they call that Rocky Point out there, and Cape Darby was the one right across the other side of the bay.
Oh, yes, yes. You know them better than I do. I flew over them, but never looked at the names too much.
He knows the map like his hand.
Well, I flew that mail run down there for many years, you know, and of course we got to know every creek and rock and everything along that coast.
Sure, sure. Well, I took Al Lohman and Dan Crowley. It was Ralph Lohman and Dan Crowley down to Golovin, and then I took Dan Crowley and the reindeer herder.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was from Finland, I believe. He was a very good reindeer man. And they located them in fine shape. It was worth a lot to them.
The bars were some of the laps.
Well, bars, yeah, they were laps.
Mm-hmm. Oh, laps. Yeah. That's right.
Wasn't the bars, but go on.
Laplander, yeah.
Yeah.
So, that was very successful for the Lohman brothers. It's only 70 miles from Nome, well, a little farther to where we found the reindeer. But we landed at Golovin.
Well, now, have the animals moved as a herd, and they had just lost track
of
them?
Yes, that's right. They keep moving, and they didn't have a herder out there with them who could run in and tell them where they were.
Were there any caribou in the country at that time?
There were more caribou. If I remember right, they would mix once in a while,
that's
too.
That's what I was wondering.
But there never was any caribou on the Seward Peninsula in the years that I was over there, but I understand many years before that there had been caribou
there
down there.
There had been, No, they weren't mixed with the reindeer herds that I saw. Up north, Seward Peninsula, they had a big herd up there on the peninsula, Chorus Peninsula. And we landed there in 1927, Gene Miller and I, and he took a lot of pictures. They were kind of rounding them up. That was a large herd, about 20,000 reindeer. It was very interesting. I don't have any of those pictures because Gene Miller took them, I guess, all. But
now, who's Gene Miller was that?
He was a third partner of ours. He'd been a movie photographer of a group that came in from Hollywood, and he liked the country, so he stayed here, and he helped us buy that first Hisso Standard. So he became a third owner, Ralph and Gene Miller. But then we bought him out later because he had no mechanical
aptitude
and wasn't doing us much good in any way, and so we asked to buy him out. He didn't like it at first, but okay, we paid him a profit on his share that he had bought, but he was taking pictures, using a lot of them just for himself, but he was a very nice fellow. We liked him very much. I got along fine with him in Nome. We lived there all summer together in the hotel, traveled and flew. He flew with me up north of there, Candle Deering, Kotzebue, Kewalik, Moses, Elephant Point, and the Chorus Peninsula, Kotzebue. Took pictures everywhere.
But you know, in all the years I've flown in Alaska, which has been 30 years now, I really had more fun over there on that Seward Peninsula out of Nome than any place I ever lived. I don't know why it is, but barren as that country is, and I always had more fun around Nome than Fairbanks or any place else.
Well, Bob likes to fish, and ptarmigan hunting was good.
Yeah.
Well, there was one thing about it. Over there, 5 minutes after you got it in your car or truck or whatever, you were out in the middle of nowhere, outside of town there.
True.
You know, in Fairbanks here, you know, you have to drive for a long ways before you get away from where people are in their cars.
That's
And
very true.
And the fishing was good in all the streams over there in the summertime. There was lots of ptarmigan in the fall and the winter. And times
really
when the rabbits were thick, they would be good over there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And,
it's like eating chicken.
Yeah.
Good, when they're good.
Oh, they were good when I first went over there, 44 and 45. And
yeah.
About 46, they all disappeared.
Were they jackrabbits?
Oh, they were big ones. You hold them up like this and they...
Yeah. They were mostly jackrabbits.
Yeah.
There weren't any
big snowshoe rabbits? Or
cottontails around here.
Yeah. These were big things.
Yes.
And they were thick over there. They'd, they'd even be all over the airport there, you know.
They call them Arctic hare, I guess.
Yeah, yes. But didn't they make a comeback?
In all the years I was over there, from about 46 to 58, they never came back in that time, although there was a lot of rabbits down around in Gallic and, you know, below Koyuk and up in the Cougarock there was some.
Yeah.
And there was lots of them up on the Kobuk and the Noatak up above Kotzebue there.
Yeah.
Because I used to land on skis up there on the Kobuk, you know, in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah, sure.
We'd put on our snowshoes and go out there in the spruce and the willows, you know, and we'd knock over all the rabbits we wanted. They were all over the place.
Huh. Sure.
You weren't a hunter, though.
Like what?
You've never done much hunting in this country, have you?
No, just some moose hunting. I shot two moose altogether in the 40 years I was...
Yeah.
Flying until retiring. 50 years now, but the last 15 years.
So many men who come to Alaska make their home here because they love to hunt and fish. But your world of adventure was a little different. You
yes, I wasn't too crazy about hunting, just for the meat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the wife would go out with me.
But the thing was, in those days, more people lived off the country.
Yes.
You know. They didn't depend on the beef and all. In fact, in the years we lived over there in Nome, we ate more reindeer meat over there than we ever ate beef.
Yeah.
Because all the beef, all the butter, all the eggs, all the coffee, everything came in on that last boat over there in the fall, you know. And
sure.
That had to last all winter.
Yeah,
and it sure did.
So people all over Alaska in those days, you know, they lived a good bit off the country for their meat.
Well, this summer of 29, let's see, you were married that May.
May.
When did you get acquainted with Ada to further your, when did you court? What was your, did you spend some time there, 28?
27, when we flew the Hissel Standard over to start our operations in Nome.
I see.
Labory and the Fairbanks Airplane Company would sell us that old airplane, which they were not going to use anymore, needed some work, quite a lot of work, and they didn't want it. They had the Swallow and the Fokker and another airplane, and they wanted to sell it. But they said, if you don't compete with us here, we'll sell it to you. Well, we plan on going to Nome. We're going to open up flying in Nome. Well, that's fine then. They got together as directors. They weren't very active in 27. Oh, they were quite active. But they said they got together and said, okay, we'll sell it to you. It was just cash in their pocket, $750. And my brother Ralph was a good mechanic, and he did they work on it while working at the NC powerhouse. He would spend extra hours then in the evening getting it ready. We had to put on new radiator, which they had there, and do some patching, a few other little things that would put it in shape. Finally got it going, and it worked fine. Very good. So we took off for Nome with the Hissel Standard. Gene Miller went with me as a photographer. He had quite a few cameras, being a movie photographer. He's still living in Portland area. We see him once in a great while. He's older than I am. He's 80, around 80 now. So we went over there and we had good success. That old Hissel engine worked fine all summer. Put in 140 hours, I remember that. Then we cleared $4,000 net over gas, oil, and what little wages we...
That was pretty good business then, wasn't
yes.
it?
I was busy all the time over there.
Mm-hmm.
Flying north to all these points, and it was a wonderful airplane to get in small places.
Well, the mining was busy up in that country
yes.
in those days, in the Cougar Rock.
It was.
All over the place, really.
I remember going into Candle, a native woman, Eskimo woman, with a little baby, said her husband was mining out 50 miles southeast of there, and they thought there was a dome, mountain dome over there I could land on.
Mm-hmm.
She was the only one that knew about it. Well, maybe others in Candle knew too, but I didn't want to go over there and risk this airplane because I had so much work to do on good, fairly decent fields, like Deering had a good field, and Kotzebue, and sandbars here and there to go on, land on a mountain, hilltops, 2,500 feet up above surrounding ground. And I says, well, I'll try it. She was just all but crying. She wanted to get over there so badly where her husband and another fellow were mining, I forgot.
Is that up the Kiwanis River someplace?
Yes, it was right up the river.
Mm-hmm. But on the east side?
Yes, mm-hmm. on the east
that
side.
That kind of heads up in those little round hills over
yes.
there.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's about 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Said, well, I'll try it. If it doesn't look good, I'll bring you back, of course, and I won't charge you anything for it. I think I charged $50 if I landed her there. Well, this dome looked pretty good, and I flew over it. I'd come in, approach it, landing and give it the gun. Three times I did this, just to get the wind and the feel, which I usually had to do, or did. And finally I says, I think I can make it. I'll put it right on a little slope here. It's kind of a shale rock deal, and it looks smooth, fairly smooth, just moss-covered rock.
Mm-hmm.
Smooth. And I landed here and then I run up. There was a prominent point a little farther up. I said, well, I can run up there and I'll stop. I can stop against that.
Mm-hmm.
It was gradual slope. I had to figure it out on these three passes. See?
Mm-hmm.
There's only 300 feet total.
My word.
And I said, I think I can make it by landing hill up the hill a little bit. That'll slow me up some, and I hit the ground at 35 miles an hour, or 40 at the most, and then I'll be slowing down fast in the next 200 to 300 feet, and then I got a little upgrade I can stop, mm-hmm. which worked out just perfect, and I made it nicely. Boy, it wasn't long till those men were up to the top of the dome there. She didn't go down until they came up. And I waited for them, be sure that they saw us, because I circled over them each time. And they knew who was coming very well. So I thought that was pretty good. I was tickle pink to get her there. And I made a little bit profit on that. Flew on back with no damage to the airplane. That was one of the incidents that first summer. That was the first dome landing I had to land on over there. Of course, I landed on two domes out of here. First one, I had a forced landing. 1925, we'd put in an engine supposedly overhauled by Lincoln Standard, Lincoln, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
That was Standard headquarters.
That was quite an aviation center
yes,
in those days.
Yes, it was.
In fact, even up until World War II, that was one of the
yeah.
biggest flying schools there, the Lincoln Flying
that's
School.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, we had this new engine, and I was making the first flight to Livengood with this engine, and I made it fine over, and on the return, I was flying below. I thought this would be a perfect engine. I was flying below Wickersham Dome out here, if you know where it is.
Yeah,
halfway to Livengood. Trail used to go right over the top of it. I was flying below that shelf on this side, coming back, make a little better speed. All of a sudden, the water came out, swoosh, one big splash, And I knew something had busted, and I said to myself, it must be a pump that would go like that. Mm-hmm. Where the water came from, I still don't know, but it came out. And the engine sputtered a little bit, covered with this water, but then it cleared up quickly from the blast, and I opened it wide, and I had almost 500 feet to climb and go around to the back. That's mm-hmm. on the north side and come south. Mm-hmm. I'd figured this out on many other flights. Mm-hmm. And I knew the top. It was kind of shale rock sticking sideways like this, mm-hmm. up. And then I could tell from the air that it was fair landing. And I came in there and plunked in. It was 600 feet total. A drop off on all sides and a shelf to the higher point. And I made it fine and run in about halfway. And I turned off a little to the side, so I figured maybe I'd be flying the Jenny over if we got out okay and land there too, which I did. But I figured it out. I didn't take the pump off and to carry it all the way, but we figured it was the pump, and it had to be the pump. Bennett, A. Bennett, that came in a few days before, thought it was the pump too. He'd been mechanic his early days, and he was much older than I was. But we took the Jenny and flew back over. First, I'll say we had two passengers. A fellow named Irwin, Jack Irwin, who was an old-timer over in Lavengood, but a young, middle-aged. So he was tough and could walk good, but the insurance adjuster that had gone over to adjust an insurance deal on a mill, sawmill that burned in Lavengood. Mm-hmm. A little fellow, Oxford's on, never had to do anything like that, walk out. Well, these tussocks were in the trail. We had to go around the Wickersham Dome and get over to the trail, the Livengood Trail. Mm-hmm. I knew where it was, and I knew where a little bit of a cabin was, or a waypoint on the trail. So we got there that night, but he was already beginning to get sore. His Oxfords, you know, that's awful hard walking on these mountain slopes. So we stayed there overnight. They had a little food in there too, mm-hmm. and we had a little with us. So I carried some of that with us. But it was 22 miles total to Olenus on the Chattanooga River, yes. where the highway comes. Mm-hmm. The highway was there then. But this dog trail was full of these tussock, mm-hmm. I'll call them niggerheads while there's no colored people around, it's easier. Just full of those, see? Mm-hmm. And it's almost as bad as out in the brush, mm-hmm. except that you didn't have the burnt over spruce trees, mm-hmm. see, that stopped you.
You find some of these things that are this high, like this, you know, and you don't know whether to step on them or step around them, you know.
That's the truth. If you step on them, you fall over. They don't have any base. They just roll over with
you. There's all kinds of tundra.
Tough deal. Well, he just about played out. We had to... The final walking, we had to get on each side of him. His ankles and feet were so sore that they pained him, I guess. I can't make it, he says, I can't make it. And we took a lot of time. And we'd rest every little while. And Jack Irwin and I would get on each side, and he'd get his arm around us. And boy, that was easy walking for me then, because I'd had... experience that same spring, you see, mm-hmm. this long walk.
That's right, this is the same year.
Yeah, same year.
My gosh.
We finally got him there, but boy, was he tired and sore. Then there was a phone there at Olenus, and we called up. I remember Fred Struthers, who was a vice president of Fairbanks Airplane Company, came out with his nice Buick, six-cylinder Buick, open car. One of the nice cars of town. It had red leather upholstery, and it's a red car. So he came out and brought us in. Well, that was an easy flight for me, a walk, I mean. And the next day, I think it's the next day, we got a pump from the other engine, or we had one, and flew out there, and we took a spare wheel, a Jenny spare wheel. This was the OH5 Jenny that we had to take then, because the other Hisra Standard wasn't ready to go yet for some reason or another. And I took Bennett. He sat in front seat, and I sat in the pilot seat in the back and did the flying, because I knew the spot. I guess he trusted me enough then, but he was a scaredy cat. And came over there, and I approached this hillside just like I had with the Standard. And I was even with the thing like this, and I was going to fly it on, which I usually did in a short landing. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was up a little higher, but he was in the habit, I found out later, of stalling down, yeah, like this.
3 point.
And with the power on, you see. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't spot within 10 feet of the end by mm-hmm. doing it that way. I learned my own way of mm-hmm. flying in. I didn't have to pull out,
yeah,
by coming down or mm-hmm. stalling. So it scared the daylights out of him. He's in the front seat, just up. He was afraid I was going to hit the side of the mountain, you know. He was sure I was going to hit the side. Well, I had power on. I trusted the OH5 that much mm-hmm. to land there. I wanted to land short because the Standard was sitting over here and not too much room before the drop-off on the right and the Standard. And I have a picture showing the two of them there together. It shows how close I had to come. Sure. But I stopped right at the Standard, the same distance. Ah! Never forget him. Then I said,
he was shaking like a leaf when he got up.
Well, I don't remember for sure, but he was cussing a little bit. And gosh, I thought you were going to hit the hill and all that. He was older than I was. He was about 50 then, and I was still pretty young. 25, I was 26 years old. And I think he was about 45 then, but he looked old to me. So we put the pump on, took it off, and we found that it was the pump, and we carried water in the airplane over there. So I had a pretty fair load. And we filled it up, and everything was fine. We started the engine, it worked good and circulated. And I said, you better take the Standard now, because that'll get off in half of this. Oh, no, he says, I've been flying the Jennies. He said, I know the Jenny, but I don't know that thing. And he was worried about the engine, I think, anyway, because the Jenny was working. He knew that. So, this was interesting. We got clear over to the end, both airplanes, and I had the engine running when he was ready to take off. We pulled her right up close backwards to the drop-off, and he took off. He used the whole 600 feet getting off and then dropped down, and I couldn't see him over the bluff. Mm-hmm. You know, and I said, well, I hope he made it. I think he would make it. I think he might have dropped to get speed himself, where it would have held up. But he disappeared for quite a few seconds. Then pretty soon he came up over. Oh. And you know, of course I took off in half the top. Terrific performance in a Hisra Standard light. And I never forget. He went to the hotel and told, he didn't mention that I was along at all, but he had gone over and landed on this mountain. I think he was telling him he landed on this mountain at the Nordale Hotel. And, oh, you talk about hard, he says, and terrible, he says. The drop down, way down the side of the mountain before I got speed up. And the fantastic tales that he told about that flight, because he'd been so scared, you know. He was still scared, I guess, from the...
And it magnified in his mind.
Both landing and the takeoff, see?
Yes.
But I think I could have got off quicker than he, because if I remember right, he was a tail dragger on mm-hmm. takeoff.
Yeah.
And you can't get speed if mm-hmm. you do that. You've got to get the Jenny or a low-powered airplane tail high so your wings are cutting air mm-hmm. or diving a little, because mm-hmm. the wheels will roll all right mm-hmm. to get the most speed, and then come up and you can
get
pull her off
that way. Mm-hmm.
When you know you're getting the speed. Now, I'm sure I'd have got off in plain sight and gone up right away. That's why I want him to take the Hissel standard.
Yeah.
That would get off no matter what he did to mm-hmm. it, see? But he hadn't flown them before.
Mm-hmm.
Afraid of it, and he never flew the Fokker.
Mm-hmm.
The Fokker was there, 25, and I was flying it right along, but he got in it and taxied it around, just in a little circle around there,
mm-hmm.
and it was so odd to him, sitting up there by the radiator in the side of the engine, and the engine would scare him in the first place,
mm-hmm.
might catch fire, and it'd take him first, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pilot that would sit only in the back. He didn't ever fly a cabin airplane there.
Mm-hmm.
They had a Stinson that Tom Girard had bought. He was another pilot mechanic of Bennett wrote about. And he wouldn't fly that airplane.
Mm-hmm.
No, he flew
was
the
that
rear.
The Detroiter?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Stinson Detroiter,
yeah.
First biplanes that
mm-hmm.
were built. You know. Mine was the fifth one that Stinson built. Wilkins told me about it, Eielson, at the time. And, Bennett ordered through Bennett and Thompson. It was Bennett and Thompson. It's called Bennett Rodebaugh Airplane Company.
Mm-hmm.
But Thompson was the other partner.
Mm-hmm.
And Rodebaugh got out of it soon, but they kept his name in it. That he couldn't get along with those two fellas at all.
Hmm.
Well, they ordered a Zenith airplane, and it had to be a rear cockpit and a cabin for four in front,
mm-hmm.
covered over.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't fly anything but a rear cockpit.
Hmm.
He says, if anything happens, I'm forced down or so, I'm going to be in the tail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be the forward one. Catch it, he says. Get
you
backed
know,
up.
Men who have made, who have remained in this country and stayed with it, you know, they've had to be courageous people.
Well, it takes
a certain amount of wisdom,
of love for the country.
Yes,
or you wouldn't do it. It'd be horrible.
But you know, when you take an airplane like you're talking about with a cockpit in the back like that, and you flop it over on its back. You kind of sail for a long ways when you're going through the air like that until you hit the ground. It's not like that plane you were talking about, you know, the Fokker at Ruby, where you were sitting up on the front. You didn't go very far.
I sure didn't. I didn't even feel it, see?
Yeah.
I didn't even get tight in the belt.
Yeah.
It went over slow, but
mm-hmm.
clear over.
Right.
Like this, see? Yeah. Well, any other particular...
Oh, I had a lot of
flight
questions.
That you...
Not a particular flight, but you know, I was just thinking about all the different kinds of cargo. You hauled the white fox off of the ship over there
yes.
in Siberia. Now Bob has hauled walrus. One time he was hauling some little walrus for a zoo or something.
It was for the zoo down... Marine... Land of the Pacific down there at Los Angeles.
Oh, yes.
There'd been a fellow offered some money for these walrus, and of course in the springtime up there at Cape Prince of Wales and Gamble
yes.
and all over, why,
yes.
when they'd be shooting walrus, why, they'd usually get some babies. And so this fellow had offered so much money for these baby walrus if they could be gotten into Nome safely.
Yes.
And so this particular time, I was up to Nome on the mail, or up to Cape Prince of Wales on the mail run, and they had two small baby walrus. The fellas up there tied in gunny sacks.
Yes.
They put them in on the floor. The seats were out in the back there and stacked. And they tied the seat belts around the walrus.
Here
was the walrus in the gunny sack with her head sticking out, you know, and the seat belt around them.
Sure.
And one of the Eskimo boys says, said, you want to watch this one fella here, he's pretty active. And so he shut the door. I took off on the beach up there and climbed out around Cape Mountain up there.
Yes.
And I didn't anymore get past Tin City there, you know, and I hear this noise in the back. I looked around and this little male walrus had come out of his gunny sack and was headed for the baggage compartment in the back. So there wasn't anything I could do, you know, because I had to stay up there in the front and fly the airplane.
Sure.
Now this was an old 1819 Gullwing Stinson.
Mm-hmm.
And so that little walrus crawled around the baggage compartment up back there for a few minutes and didn't find anything to his liking. So pretty soon he turns around and he comes back the way he'd gone, and he comes up in the front and he tries to get up in the cockpit between the two front seats there. So I stuck one hand down on the seat next to me there that was empty, and this little guy sticks his head underneath of my arm and puts his head on my lap. See, that was as far as he could get.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know what to do at that point, and so I just kind of scratched him behind the ear a little bit like you would a dog, you know, and
yeah,
the first thing you know, he went to sleep. When I landed at Nome, he was still asleep with his head on my lap.
Well, that's an experience.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, we...
I've never had that.
We took those little walrus, you know, and we got an Eskimo from town there that seemed to know a little bit about the walrus, and they fixed up the place for them and, you know, kept them wet and that sort of thing. And somebody from Alaska Airlines sent a wire to this fella down in L.A. there, you know.
Yeah.
And
Greenland.
Yeah, he came up in a couple of days and they boxed the walrus up and I guess they flew them out on Alaska Airlines flight to Anchorage or something, mm-hmm, and then on down to
Los Angeles.
Seattle and L.A. with one of the 46s.
Uh-huh. But you never hold any walrus that climbed into your lap? Or?
No, I've never had any that type of experience.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering what your strangest cargo might have been. Or most unusual cargo.
You know, I haven't had any very unusual. I haven't hauled any reindeer personally, but I haul a lot of dogs.
Uh-huh.
A whole team. I think I hauled a whole team in, three, four dogs at a time in the Stinson first, and then I believe, if I remember right, I hauled a larger team in the Hamilton once. We took all the seats out,
mm-hmm,
but one, and the owner or driver of the team stayed with them, and they hugged the floor pretty well. They
mm-hmm
didn't get around at all. They were very good.
Mm-hmm.
Animals can be, I think, you know, they're unpredictable. You can't tell them what to do very well.
No.
Be sure they're going to do it.
No, I hadn't had any such experience.
Well, there in the middle 50s, somebody started taking live reindeer down to the States to use at
yes
Christmas time.
That's
and
there's right
a fellow by the name of Grady Carruthers that came up from Fort Worth to Nome
oh
to get some reindeer. And he made a deal with the reindeer herder down at Gallivan to get 12 reindeer, I believe it was, up to Nome. And he chartered a C-46 there and he put stalls and everything in it. Mm-hmm. Even the reindeer moss, they bagged up a lot of moss to go
yeah
along with the reindeer.
Yeah.
And so I went down to Gallivan with the old Pilgrim.
Yeah.
And another fellow went down there with the Norseman.
Uh-huh.
And they rounded up the reindeer in the corral over across the bay from the village.
Uh-huh.
And they tied the reindeer's 4 feet together and then took a loop around one of the horns and tied the horns to the feet so that
oh
the reindeer was kind of wrapped up in a circle.
Yeah.
And they lifted these reindeer into the boat and ran them across the bay. And when they'd get enough for a load, which was about, I guess it must have been about 8 or 10, they put them in the airplane. Now, I remember this was about the 1st of November. And there was just a little bit of snow on the ground over there.
Yeah.
We were still on wheels.
Yeah, sure.
But I know that these reindeer were had so much body heat that it frosted up the windows inside of the Norseman and the Pilgrim both, you know, from that tremendous amount of heat.
Yes.
And so I had to fly out of there and all the way back to Nome with a window down on the left side, you know, so I could get enough air to keep the windshield clean.
Certainly, yeah.
But we hauled a lot of reindeer after that for various people.
Yeah.
These particular reindeer went down to Fort Worth, and they got an old sleigh from someplace up in the northern states there someplace and put wheels on it. And they rigged up some harness for the reindeer. They put the names of the reindeer, and Nixon, Blixen, and whatever the names of them were, you know. And they used them with the big department stores down there in Fort Worth during Christmas time, and they dressed somebody up like Santa Claus, you know, and put him in this old sleigh, and they'd drive these reindeer around the town.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever meet Stephenson when he came through? Did he?
Yes. We had him to dinner once in our big house, which is now Bishop Gordon's.
Oh.
Yeah, we had him to dinner one day, and he sat there telling stories galore. He was a most interesting fellow as a speaker, just like Sir Hubert Wilkins. Boy, he's a terrific speaker, but we liked Stephenson.
I heard Wilkins once.
Did you?
Yes, I didn't meet him, but I heard him in a lecture. I went, I think in Anchorage, we did go up and meet him, you know, but didn't know him, just met him. But I was impressed tremendously with him, and
He became a real good speaker nationally.
Mm-hmm.
He was so interesting.
Is this Stephenson?
No, Wilkins.
Wilkins, yeah.
Well, Stephenson was good, too, of course. But
now,
somebody I
talked to, and I'm just trying to remember who it was, told me that he had gone up, let's see, when Stephenson came down from Barter Island, he went up to up the Porcupine with a dog team from here and picked him up. And they mushed back down together. And his opinion of Stephenson was not quite as high as Mr. Stephenson's opinion of himself seems to be.
No.
This fellow that I talked to that had mushed with him. I think he my-manned him quite a bit.
Yes, I imagine.
In 1918, when Stephenson got finished with that expedition, he got pneumonia or something up there at, I believe it was at Herschel Island.
Herschel Island, yes.
Oh.
And
that's what it was.
Somebody up there put him on the dog sled, and they...
And the Mounties took him down to whatever it is, on the Arctic Village or something.
No, they took him down to Fort Yukon.
Well, this guy picked him up from the Mounties on the border.
Well, that could be. But
anyhow,
he wound
him
up in
Fort
the
Yukon.
Hospital or whatever they
Yukon.
Had there
That's
at
right.
Fort Yukon.
Fort Yukon.
Yeah.
Somebody I interviewed when I was doing this radio series, I interviewed him at Nenana, and I think it was this man's father. Anyway, at any rate, apparently Stephenson had called him my man and had wanted his tea made at the proper time and, you know, had wanted a little bit of service.
Oh.
And but yet there was something, he said he was supposed to be sick, but he said when it came to doing something, he got out there and we didn't really think he was as sick as he let on. So, you know, that was the only adverse story I ever heard about him. But I thought it was kind of interesting that Stephenson was apparently human, too.
Oh, yes. He's the guy that lived on meat intentionally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Alone to survive. Or he wanted to prove that...
One could survive...
That meat had vitamins in it and vitamin C and such. He lived a year or straight or something like that. Up in the Arctic somewhere. I forgot where it was.
By eating all the visceral portions of the animal.
Uh-huh. And seal oil,
of course. The internal organs and the oil.
Would be seal oil, what do they call it? That other oil that... Well, I forgot the name now. Cod liver oil.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's no doubt about it that the oils are very rich in all these.
Yes, that's how Eskimos get along so well and are so healthy and didn't get sick. It was a vitamin of some kind.
And did you ever fly up in the Arctic regions? Did you ever get up to that area? what is now called the, well, the North Slope. The
oh, I grew quite a little in there, 28. Of course, I was stuck at Barrow 27 days straight.
Oh, you were?
When we first went up with Russell Merrill of Anchorage with the Fox Film Expedition to get whaling pictures. I had the Stinson on wheels, and Russell Merrill was on wheels. This was May 13th we took off here. Never forget the date. And up at the North Slope, you couldn't tell it was summer at all. It was winter. There hadn't been any thawing of any kind, and we were forced to land 100 miles from... I'll say we landed at Wiseman and gassed up. I couldn't go through, even with that 110 gallons of gas that Wilkins had put in. We sat on a gas tank. I forgot, 40-some gallons, and then the two upper wing tanks, 110, 112 altogether. But I couldn't go through. The old biplane was fairly slow, 90 miles an hour cruising. And Russell Merrill couldn't with his travel air, his five-place travel air either. So we landed on the bar at Wiseman and gassed up. Took off from there, and then, past the Colville River, we got through the range all right, straight up from Wiseman through a pass there. I think it's the same pass the pipeline is going.
Yeah, if you followed the the river on up past Dietrich, you would have gone over the pass there and maybe gotten on to the Adigan River up there where it goes down into Chandelier Lake.
Yes.
Or Galbraith Lake.
Galbraith.
That's the way the pipeline goes. Uh-huh. And it's not too high across that pass up there.
No, I see. Here it isn't.
So we got down
below the Colville, and that northeast wind, the prevailing wind that comes in across the Arctic, here comes a fog bank. It was up to 5,000 feet at our altitude and on a little higher. And it was solid, and it was like a wall just drifting in.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down then to the ground in front of it, thinking maybe it could get under it and go on straight on to Barrow. No, it was right on the ground, absolutely on the ground, flat ground, of course, everywhere. So I didn't want to waste any more gas looking or even going toward Wainwright. But I made a mistake there. I was kind of leading. Russell Merrill let me do the leading because I'd had a little more Arctic experience, but not much. And I decided to land on a lake before we'd run out of gas. And I landed fine, run along good on top, but I had the old Fokker three wheels on, 2 inches bigger than the original Stinson wheels, or the same as Russell Merrill had. And the Stinson had brakes on, and the gear was farther forward, and the tendency not to nose over as much. The tail was heavier. But Russell Merrill's travel air, the gear was more normal under, and he landed fine without nosing over. But I was able next day to take off with one of the Fox Film men, Ewing Scott, the leader, and a few hundred pounds of film and cameras. He wanted to get the film out of there because it couldn't stand freezing. So I took off fine, headed for Barrow, and I found Barrow. I found Tishapuk Lake, that big lake up
Tishapuk,
there.
Tishapuk.
First, and then I found the coast. It was hard to find the coast, only by the dog trails. To tell.
That's a very hard coast to fly and to follow.
Yeah.
I flew that Dew Line for 2 years up there.
Did
59
you?
And 60, you know, with
twin
beaches.
That's right.
But that coast was very hard to follow.
Yes, even on a clear day, it's kind of a whiteout.
Yeah.
Well,
flew by radio navigation up there most of the time between sites at that time.
Oh, yes.
So we didn't really
have to follow. This was 30 years before. They
didn't
have that.
Well, yeah, but I know what it is to follow that coast if you have to follow.
So I found Barrow, all right, and we loaded up with shovels and on gas, extra gas, right away. Hart and I took off right away. He came back with me. You know, we couldn't find the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Clear and unlimited. That was 100 miles direct line, but that northeast, about 20 mile an hour average northeast wind was drifting it. I had no way to tell on the compass. I had compass in the airplane, but I had no way to tell returning just where I should keep that compass. And if you're off a mile or two, you can't see an airplane sitting on a lake.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed it, maybe by 3 or 4 miles.
Mm.
We flew all around in there and came all the way back. And I think the next day we had a good day too, or almost immediately, because we wanted to get up there before this fog bank would roll in again in May, you know. That's where the bad weather comes, the fog rolls in. So we took off again, and I still couldn't find it. And I racked my brain as much as I knew how. Where should it be? This way or that way in going up there?
And the country all looks alike anyway.
Yes. I went to the river, Chesicpuk, I think it is. Right near the lake there. And I followed that out to where I thought we were 15 miles farther east from that river. I found that out coming back in. And if I'd only come down to that river and landed on a lake near the river or on the river, it would have been simple. I never thought of that, and I didn't really know how far that river was when we did land, because I hadn't seen it yet. So, I'd strike in from the river, about where I thought it should be, but you could be off 3 or 4 miles so easy. And you know, we made 6 flights out there in about 20 days. Fog would roll in so often. And I flew many days.
And he didn't gather any moss to put up a smoke signal for you.
Well, it would have been hard. He had nothing to burn there.
Yes.
All covered, no brush, hardly any brush. All snow.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, and tundra.
Sure.
There was nothing to burn. And no open places. The sun hadn't really melted snow off the banks where it might... You might burn something.
Available.
Well, anyway, the 6th trip, Matt Niemann then came up with the other travel air via Kotzebue, Ruby and Kotzebue. And on one of my trips in there, well, I made 1 5-hour-long trip. I zigzagged back and forth out there, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't find it. It'd be a little black dot on the lake if I got somewhere near. Well, the fog was rolling in, and these banks of fog that hit the ground and then places between them, like this.
Right.
Well, it was pretty thick. I couldn't go any farther, so I landed by Tommy Brower's reindeer camp. And we hired the man that was there. He was a young fellow then with a wife and a baby. And I slept in his tent for one night, and I got my mouth full of reindeer hair because they had reindeer all over the bottom of the tent.
Yeah.
Sure.
Gee, this was rough. I was always cleaning the hair up. Somehow the hair finds your mouth.
Yeah. Everybody used to sleep in reindeer sleeping bags in those days.
Yeah.
Even the bush pilots carried them.
Yes.
When I first met John Cross up there, you know, at Nome, he had an old reindeer sleeping bag in there.
Sig
it was
had
kind
one.
Of a joke amongst the bush pilots, and somebody came into town after being out of town a while, and they had this reindeer hair all over, and the saying was, well, whose reindeer sleeping bag were you sleeping in?
Yes.
Well, those reindeer bags always shed hair.
Terribly.
I remember they were burning this oil that they chop out of the lake. Chunks, kind of hard oil on the surface of the lake.
petroleum oil type.
Yes, it was petroleum oil. It was right near that area there. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. His camp was near that lake, that big lake, but one side or the other.
Cape Simpson is where the that one big oil seep is up there.
Yeah, well, that's near where we were.
Yeah, it's not too far.
Of course, I didn't know anything about oil being there, but he was burning this in a 5-gallon can. That's all they used for burning.
Huh.
And he'd go chop it out of the lake where I landed there. They were just on the bank of the lake. With the reindeer herd was quite close. Well, one night was enough for me, so I went out and slept in the cabin of the airplane. It wasn't too cold in May, you see. Mm-hmm. Chilly, but not cold. I had a sleeping bag, and I slept much better there. I didn't get that reindeer hair in my mouth. But I had quite a few rations. I remember I gave them a lot of my rations, because I felt I would soon be back in Barrow. They were sure tickled to get it, too. I forgot what food it was, but...
Well, how did you find your friend, the traveler?
Well, finally, the first trip that Matt Neiman and I went out together then, after this camping there on this lake with the reindeer herd, I finally got in, flying low between the fog banks, and roared over town, over Charlie Brower's place where we were sleeping. And there was this other airplane, and I said, oh, that's the other travel air. That's a small open cockpit. Mm-hmm. The one Russell Merrill had on the lake there that we flew in was a cabin in front mm-hmm. for four people. Same size engine, though, J4Bs. And so Matt was ready to go, but we didn't go out then. I said the flying was too hard. We couldn't find anything in that kind of condition because I was dodging these fog banks all the way in along the coast. So I think about the next day, we took off together, and I took a different course, what I thought was a different course each time. And by golly, we hit it. And Matt Niemann was on my right, and we both saw it at about the same time, as close as we could see any object. You know, we were looking back and forth. We both banked just about the same time and went down there, and I landed with skis. Oh, I had Sir Hubert Wilkins' skis on my airplane then, mm-hmm. but one had been broken. That's why he left them there. They were Seversky streamlined metal ski, narrow, and streamlined from the nose back. And they had two pegs for pedestal stand. And he'd broken those off somehow. And we fashioned a big block of wood and tied it, strapped it by riveting, punching holes on the side, and put straps over this block of wood.
Mm-hmm.
And the axle then through the wood, mm-hmm. drilled a hole. We did that at Barrow. And I had a semblance of a ski. Yeah, they wobbled quite a little, but it worked, mm-hmm. and I didn't bust it. So I had skis on. Matt Niemann had my wheels on mm-hmm. that I'd taken off to put these skis on. So he could have landed right beside him, but that wasn't for him. He didn't think that was possible. But the sun had melted the snow on the bank of the river, up about 50 feet or so. So he tried to land on that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was worse than going in on the lake. And he nosed over and bent one blade of the prop. And we bent it back, the two of us, some manner. I forgot how we did it, but it was only couple inches out, mm-hmm. but he was able to take off then, and I don't remember whether he took off up on top there. The drifted snow would be the same hardness.
Mm-hmm.
It was drifted all the way through in layers. Mm-hmm. That's why I was able to stay on top.
Oh, yeah.
He might have found a way to get down, but I don't think so. I think he took off right on top because the banks were about 10-foot banks.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over to the airplane. Of course, here was all the rest of the camera equipment with a black changing bag mm-hmm. as a cover. And they had it all piled out on the snow, on the ice. And then Russell Merrill had a diary in the cockpit of the airplane.